Yeah, so I didn't actually write it out because in general people do it numerically.
Right.
But the output of that differential equation is that transfer function, that Green's function.
Right.
So I'll write it up now for good measure. I guess in a slightly different form. So this is what I was writing at the end of the class yesterday. The flux at our position at a given energy is going to be the velocity of the particle coming in. This is usually just c over 8 pi. Times the annihilation cross section. And we normalize it by the local dark matter density. And then you integrate over all possible sources that can contribute to the energy you see. And you put in a transfer function. So I'll define this in a second. So I'll put subscripts just to make it clear that I'm looking at a specific concentrated species. Let's say a positron or electron or proton or antiproton. That's what the I labels. So this piece is basically particle physics. This piece is dni des. In other words, this is the fraction of this is the differential distribution of energies per annihilation. So basically, what's been done is instead of writing d sigma v de, actually I should write it. Instead of writing this thermal average has been replaced by that. But the thing is, we want to integrate now over all source energies, so all initial annihilation energies, to then get reprocessed by the propagation into the energy we see. And this corresponds to the propagation. And it's in here that this g function comes up. So for this, you integrate over all possible source positions. And at this point, you get the Green's function. So the Green's function corresponds to transfer from, you produce the cosmic ray at the source position. It propagates to our position. So I guess that should be an x sun. And then it also takes into account that your source energy can be changed into your observed energy. And on top of this, you also have to put in a piece that depends on the local dark matter density. And it depends on that density squared. And this piece, this density at our location, this dark matter density rho sun, it just cancels between here and here. So the thing it actually depends on is the source. So there should be an XS. Is the source dark matter density. But just to make everything nice and dimensionless, you divide off by the local density here, and you put it back in here. So you've got this basically particle physics thing, and this piece is also kind of particle physics, and this is astrophysics. So this is the the output of solving our diffusion equation. Is this g function. And typically what's done is you either just simulate everything in a program called Galprop or something similar, or you use a parameterization of a Galprop output for this. So this is what we had for cosmic rays. Okay, so this formula applies to both protons and antiprotons and electrons and positrons, but for these different species, in general, you're going to have a different energy density piece here, and you're also going to have a different transfer function, because for example, protons and positrons and so on propagate differently through the interstellar medium to us. Okay, so the most promising things to look at are antiprotons and positrons. And the reason for that is most of the astrophysical backgrounds will be protons or electrons, not the antiparticles. Whereas dark matter produces just as many antiparticles as particles. Typically, so it makes sense to look for the antiparticles specifically. So if I look at antiprotons, it turns out that if I look at their diffusion, these are affected, at their propagation, these are affected mostly by diffusion. And remember, the diffusion is induced by irregularities in the magnetic field surrounding the galaxy. Their propagation can also be blocked to some extent by hitting dust in the form of hydrogen and helium and possibly other stuff. So, I mean, antimatter hits matter, it goes poof. And in terms of the background, these antiprotons can also be created as secondaries from various reactions, such as I could have two protons hit each other and go P plus P bar plus P bar, for example. So this is a story for antiprotons, but typically these antiprotons propagate pretty efficiently. And in other words, they can travel a pretty good distance. And this actually turns out to make our life a little bit more complicated, because since the antiprotons can travel reasonably well, they can propagate reasonably efficiently without getting diluted or hindered too much, the upshot of this is that we pick up a sensitivity in terms of this g function, sensitivity, to the dark matter energy density, in the sense that since these antiprotons can travel pretty well, they can come from all over the galaxy, and in particular, starting to get close to the galactic center, where we don't really understand the dark matter density so well. And what else do I want to say? Well, so you're sensitive to this, and you're sensitive to various other propagation parameters. So this is for antiprotons. If I look at positrons. Positrons are a little bit more simple, in the sense that they don't travel quite as efficiently. So these are affected, of course, by diffusion. But also energy loss. So for these positrons, these the energy loss, microphone. Let me see about energy loss. So the energy loss comes from well, various things, but two primary effects. See, the energy loss comes from synchrotron. And inverse Compton scattering. So by synchrotron radiation, what I mean, oh yes?
When you for the antiprotons, when you say that they travel long distances, does that mean they give you directional information about where the dark matter distributes, like a source of something like that?
Yeah, I was about to say that. Still not really. They still get affected by this diffusion effect.
Oh, so they're still affected by the magnetic field and various.
Yeah. So I mean, a typical. So actually, yeah. I should make this point more clearly. Because of this diffusion effect. So this is a side view of our galaxy. So here's the middle. So we're here, and this is our dark matter halo, and here's the galactic plane. The point is that a dark matter annihilation here, for these protons or antiprotons or positrons or electrons, it's very unlikely for the cosmic ray to come just to us. Instead, what's going to happen is you have a diffusion process where you go all over the place. And the point is that the direction that you see the thing coming from is not the same direction, doesn't point back to where it came from necessarily. So for the most part, because of these diffusion effects, because of these diffusion effects, you don't know where the annihilation happened. So just because you see your antiproton coming in from here, it could have actually been produced over there. It just could have bounced around. If you have a source that's very close to you, then you might be able to get some directional information. But for dark matter annihilation, which is very much spread out over the halo, you don't expect any net. Really any net directional dependence because of the scrambling effect of the diffusion. Okay, but back to positrons. For positrons, they lose energy from synchrotron. And what I mean by synchrotron is that if I produce a positron or a high energy electron, they have a relatively large charge compared to their mass. And that means that they're very affected by magnetic fields, and these electrons or positrons will be accelerated by the magnetic fields and give off radio frequency radiation in the form of synchrotron. So you have your positrons spinning around in the galactic magnetic field, giving off or losing energy in the form of fairly low energy radiation. Just in the same way that if you start trying to make a particle accelerator with electrons, you start to lose a lot of energy to synchrotron. In terms of inverse Compton scattering, what this is just scattering of, for a positron in this case, I have a high energy positron, and it hits a photon. And the photons I have lying around are from starlight. And CMB photons. I think the starlight dominates over the CMB, but don't quote me on that. But in any case, you have these photons lying around the galaxy for one reason or another, and my positron can scatter off, can scatter elastically. Oops, should be the other way. My positron can scatter elastically with one of these photons. And what happens in this case is that my initial photon typically has a very low energy compared to the incoming positron energy. And what you end up getting is some of the positron energy gets transferred to the photon. And at least relative to where they started, this outgoing photon is very, very energetic. And this incoming and the outgoing positron is less energetic than what it started with. So this is just a net energy transfer from high energy positrons to photons. So I'm going to come to looking for photon signals from dark matter annihilation. And one of the sources of photon signals is this inverse Compton scattering, where if my dark matter annihilation is producing lots of high energy positrons or electrons, these high energy leptons are going to hit photons and produce inverse Compton gammas with some spectrum. But as far as the positrons themselves go, this inverse Compton scattering takes energy away from them. Okay. And just one last comment. A couple of comments. For positrons, it turns out that the energy loss can be fairly significant. The amount of energy you lose also depends on how energetic your positron is. But for high energy positrons, that were produced at very high energy, that you also observe at a very high energy, they don't travel all that far. They only travel on the order of a few kiloparsec. And the upshot of this is that going back to my little cartoon of our galaxy, the distance between the galactic center and us is about 8.5 kiloparsecs. So as far as positrons are concerned, the positrons that we see, at least the ones with very high energy, are coming from a relatively local area. Sometimes people talk about a positron sphere. And this positron sphere is not all that big. It's just some local region like that. Maybe I'll draw it in red to try to make it. So the upshot of this is that for positrons, we have, in some sense, less sensitivity to the dark matter distribution in our galaxy, and that it depends primarily on the local distribution. And just quickly, there are various astrophysical backgrounds, an example of an astrophysical background is I could have a high energy astrophysical proton cosmic ray hitting a bit of dust in the form of hydrogen, and this can produce junk plus charged pions, and a charged pion typically decays to a muon and a muon neutrino, and then the muon decays into an electron or positron plus nu mu nu e through a W. So the point is that this process, if I produce, I guess it would be pi pluses, I'm eventually going to get a positron. So you have a background of astrophysical positrons. And of course, these positrons are secondaries, not primaries. They're not produced so much directly by the supernova shocks. And that means that my positron signal that I look for will not just be from dark matter. It'll be from other stuff, too.
So 4 plus H?
H is a hydrogen nucleus. But it could be some other kind of nucleus. But in general, high-energy proton collisions and all that stuff can produce charged pions. They can produce positrons. So this is just one example. But I think it's the most likely one, just because you have more hydrogen around. OK, so the next thing I wanted to, well, the kind of fun and interesting thing is that there's been a lot of progress on looking for these signals in the past few years, and there's been a lot of excitement. And I want to tell you a little bit about what the current status of observations are. But the upshot is that it looks like we have a signal in positrons, at least a larger signal in positrons than what we would naively expect from astrophysical backgrounds. But we don't necessarily see any excess signal in antiprotons. And on top of that, the signal in positrons is a little bit puzzling. So I'm going to try to tell you the story for that. So if I look at E plus signals, the thing that is frequently looked for is the flux of positrons divided by the total flux of positrons plus electrons. And various experiments have looked for this. So I'll write it as a function of energy. And the experiments that have looked for this are, well, at least the most recent ones are Fermi and Pamela. So this Pamela experiment, I've heard various pronunciations. So it's largely a Russian and Italian collaboration. So a lot of people use what's apparently the Italian pronunciation of Pamela, which is Pamela. But I've heard people from the collaboration who happen to be Italian call it Pamela. So who knows? But in any case, Pamela or Pamela. And Fermi is another space telescope that's designed mostly to look for gamma rays, to look for high energy photons, but it also has a sensitivity to electrons. And the really big excitement came from this Pamela experiment. And let me just try to draw the result in a reasonable way. So if this is the energy. So I'm looking at the energy spectrum. So this is 1 GeV, 10 GeV, 100 GeV. And for this fraction, I'll put, I guess, about 0.1. 0.01. So what you would expect from an astrophysical background, from these secondaries, at least naively, is some falling spectrum. Let me get out the color chart for this. On the other hand, what these two experiments, see, Pamela and Fermi, they find data that more or less tracks the background at lower energies. But at energies around 10 GeV up to about 100 GeV, they see an upturn. So there's some error bars on this. And the error bars get bigger towards the end. But up to about 100 GeV, they see what looks like an uptick. So they see a net excess relative to this naive astrophysical background. So this, for obvious reasons, caused a lot of excitement in the field. And there are gazillions of theoretical models of dark matter that people have come up to explain this. There are also some puzzling aspects that I'll come to in a second. But it is a very striking signal, and it's been confirmed by these two independent experiments. So as an experimental issue, it's something there. It may be dark matter, it may be something else. Before I get into interpretations, let me also mention the story for antiprotons. So naively, at least, you would have expected that if you saw a big upturn in a positron signal, you might also be likely to see an upturn in antiprotons, especially because in a lot of our WIMP models of dark matter, you produce a relatively democratic spectrum of leptons and hadrons. So at least naively, you expect a little bit of both. The slightly puzzling thing, though, is that this is another thing that the same experiment Pamela has measured. They look at the ratio of antiproton flux to proton flux. And what they find, again, I'm taking some artistic liberties here. But what they find as, I'll draw this axis a bit higher to make it so you can see it. What they find as a function of energy, again, in GeV, is 100, 10, 1. And 100. And let me label the axes. 10 to the minus 6. what they see is something that looks like this. Or sorry, what you would expect from astro background looks something like that, and what they see in terms of data matches up pretty well. So I'll put the actual experimental plots in the note that I write up. But here there's no obvious excess, and the other thing is in the astrophysical background there's a slightly larger uncertainty in predicting it. So the astrophysical background has a fairly reasonable uncertainty band that looks kind of like that. But the point is that the data seems to lie comfortably inside the uncertainty band. So the point is that this is exciting, but also curious, and this is kind of boring. Oh, yes.
Are there like more astrophysical models for this?
Oh, there are. So I'm that's the next thing I'm getting to. Okay. Yeah. So the first thing, at least, as dark matter theorists, we should ask ourselves is, could this possibly be dark matter? And well, it's a bit of a puzzle. So first of all, we want to explain this data in a consistent way. So if you explain this positron signal, but we overpredict the antiprotons, then we're in trouble. So we want to try to explain both at once. And we also want to see what sorts of properties should the dark matter have if it is to explain this Pamela signal. OK, so it turns out that if you try to fit a dark matter interpretation to this, you can do it. But the dark matter should have slightly unusual properties. So the first thing you need, it turns out, is a fairly large annihilation cross-section. So your annihilation cross-section, and this is the annihilation cross-section, remember, today. The value that fits the Pamela data, the precise value depends a little bit on what your dark matter annihilates into. But typically, you get some number kind of on the order of unity times 10 to the minus 25 centimeters cubed per second, and a scaling with the dark matter mass okay, so this is a very rough extrapolation to fits to the data. But what you need roughly is a cross-section that is relatively large. So that's the first thing. The other thing is the heavier your dark matter, the larger the cross-section you need. And the reason for that is the heavier your dark matter, the fewer dark matter particles you have in the halo. And the scaling is with m squared. So this is a bit of a puzzle. Because remember that what we needed for thermal freeze-out of dark matter, and this was pretty much independent of the dark matter mass, for thermal freeze-out of dark matter, we did an annihilation, a thermally averaged annihilation cross-section or freeze-out of about 3 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. So the first slightly puzzling thing is why, this cross-section seems a little bit big. On its own, it might not be the end of the world. There are two things one can do. First of all, this is the annihilation cross-section in the galaxy today. Whereas this is the annihilation cross-section at freeze-out. And those might not be entirely the same. And the other thing is that we also know of non-thermal ways to produce the dark matter in which this cross-section is just not the relevant one. So this is a little bit funny, but not the end of the world. The other thing is, though, and this is a bit trickier, because there's no excess in antiproton over proton, what this usually means, roughly, is you want your dark matter really has to annihilate mostly to leptons. Or okay, maybe you don't get maybe you don't get e plus e minus. Maybe you get multiple e plus e minus, but you want a strong leptonic preference. Yeah.
Sorry, is that the best fit to what the current cross section would be? That's like the number they extrapolate from that result.
Very roughly. So I mean, this is very crude, but this is roughly what you get. Well, that's the tension.
Okay.
This fact. Well, so if I had this cross section specifically with 100 GeV dark matter particle, I would get way too little dark matter through thermal freeze out. So it does say something about either an enhancement of the annihilation cross section today, relative to a freeze out, or a non-thermal production mode. Yeah. Well, so the point is that suppose I have the highest energy positron I can get out of a dark matter annihilation is going to be 100 GeV.
And you see that, right?
Yeah. So because we only have data up to about 100 GeV, it's still going up at 100 GeV. Whereas if I had 100 GeV dark matter particle, I would expect the spectra to turn over, to be cut off very strongly. So 100 GeV is okay, but let's say like a 20 GeV, I expect to turn over kind of around here, and it just wouldn't work. So my dark matter does have to be at least somewhat heavy. Yeah, and in fact, this is one thing that various experiments are trying to do. They're trying to push this positron spectrum to higher energies. And by pushing the positron spectrum to higher energies, the hope is that you'll be able to see a turnover corresponding to the dark matter mass. Okay. The second property, though, is also a little bit funny, in that at least there's a strong, you know, a strong cultural bias or a strong sociological bias to look at popular particle physics theories to generate your dark matter particle. So, for example, one of the most popular ones and the one that's been studied the most is supersymmetry, so the MSSM. And typically, in the MSSM, you frequently get dark matter annihilating into things like W plus, W minus, or BB bar. But you don't tend to get your dark matter annihilating mostly into leptons. And for example, for annihilation modes like this, you tend to get too many antiprotons relative to leptons. So the point is that by the time you explain the Pamela positron signal, you overpredict the antiprotons. There may be a little bit of wiggle room for W plus W minus. And for W plus W minus, the wiggle room is that if you really push hard on the uncertainties in the antiproton signals, you might be able to say that what's being seen at Pamela in the antiprotons is actually signal plus background. And that the astrophysical background is just relatively low compared to kind of the central values, because you're pushing all of the propagation parameters as much as you can to suppress the astrophysical background. This is borderline okay, but it's also under a lot of tension. So the typical thinking is that you really need mostly leptonic annihilation of dark matter. So there are literally thousands of theory papers. There's a big explosion of theory papers explaining this Pamela signal when it came out. And of course, I don't have time to explain them, but I do want to go over one popular and sort of cool one, just to give you one example. Okay, so just to give you an example of one thing that could potentially explain the Pamela result. Suppose my dark matter is a hidden Dirac fermion. So now I have distinct dark matter and anti-dark matter, and I assume that I have equal populations of dark matter and anti-dark matter in the galactic halo. So I've got chi, and chi is different from chi bar. And what I mean by hidden is that this Dirac fermion isn't charged under any of the standard model gauge groups. So it doesn't interact under the weak force or anything else. But it does interact under a U1X hidden gauge symmetry. That I assume is spontaneously broken or Higgsed at about at energy on the order of 1 GeV. So the upshot of this is that my would-be massless gauge boson picks up a mass. So I'll call this gauge boson ZX. And this gauge boson mass is on the order of a GeV. For my dark matter, I'm going to assume that its mass is, of course, greater than about 100 GeV. And I'm going to assume that my Dirac fermion is charged under this gauge group. Yep.
What do you mean it's Higgs at 1 GeV?
So in the same way that you spontaneously break the electroweak gauge group, the SU2 cross U1 down to a smaller remnant unit of electromagnetism. In that case, your W and Z gauge bosons get masses. And that breaking is induced by a Higgs boson. So we call that a Higgsing. So OK, so it's just jargon, but it's just jargon, but you know the content. So the upshot of this is that we assume that this Dirac fermion is charged under this gauge group. And that means that I can have annihilations of the form chi chi to zx zx, and I can adjust the couplings of this of the gauge group such that this annihilation channel gives me the right thermal relic density. So I can get the right relic density of chi. This is a chi bar. But at this point, we also want to get rid of these hidden vectors, because otherwise they would actually be the dark matter. So to get rid of those hidden vectors, what we do is we actually couple the hidden vector to electromagnetism. And it turns out that you can do this in a gauge invariant way. So remember that the gauge kinetic term, the kinetic term of the photon or any gauge boson, has this form, f mu nu, where this f mu nu is a d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. Did you cover this in field theory? And the thing is, for U1 gauge force, this so-called field strength tensor is gauge invariant. The gauge transformation on A cancels between these two pieces. So what I can do is I can write the same, I can write my kinetic term for x. And I can also, it turns out, write a so-called gauge kinetic mixing term, which is a cross term between the kinetic pieces of this form. And it turns out that if there's ever any matter in a theory that's charged under electromagnetism and this U1x, I'll generate this coupling through loops. So I'm going to assume this epsilon is much, much less than 1.
So what was x mu?
Oh, sorry. So I have a U1x gauge force. So this is the field strength.
U1x.
Yeah. Field strength. So in other words, d mu x mu plus d nu x mu. Of Okay, but the point is that this is a cross-coupling I can write that is gauge invariant, was completely gauge invariant. It's allowed by all the symmetries, and it connects these two, and it ends up connecting my hidden gauge symmetry to the visible electromagnetic gauge symmetry.
And you said that this would be, so if you have two E1 fields, this would be generated chromomechanically?
Yeah, so for example, if I have, if I have some fermion, let's call it psi, is charged under both. When I integrate out the fermion, the theory, so if this fermion is very heavy, I can get rid of it from the theory, and its remnant effect in the effective theory will be this cross term. And it turns out it's non-decoupling in the sense that even if this fermion is very heavy, I'm still stuck with this term. Okay, so the way to get rid of, this cross mixing looks a little bit funny, but one very important thing to keep in mind with quantum field theories is that the fields you use are just variables. And you can use different variables to describe your theory in perhaps a more convenient way. So the more convenient change of variables is, and actually I'm just going to also add, remember I'm also going to have, by assumption from the Higgsing, a mass term for x. So because of the Higgs dynamics, I generate a mass term for x. And at this point, it's not gauge invariant, but in the underlying Higgs theory, it is. Okay. So what I do is, it turns out, and maybe this would be a good homework or tutorial question, I can define shifted fields. And these shifted fields are perfectly good fields to describe my theory. But the form of the shifted field is this. So if I define new fields that are shifted in this way, with S epsilon is equal to epsilon over 1 minus epsilon squared, and the C epsilon is just 1 over 1 minus epsilon squared. So this is epsilon MC epsilon. It turns out that if I make this change of variables, what I end up with is, in my field strength, I get my Lagrangian. I get very nice diagonal field strengths in terms of these prime fields. And absolutely no cross terms. So the really nice thing about this change of variables is that when I do the change of variables, I don't have any cross terms. So I've diagonalized my kinetic terms. And whenever you start with a Lagrangian where your kinetic terms are not diagonal or don't have a canonical normalization, the first thing you always want to do, in almost all cases, is diagonalize those kinetic terms. So that's what I've done. But this should be an upstairs FMU new. But of course, you never get something for nothing. And there is a physical effect of this. And that is, suppose I have a standard model fermion that couples to the photon through an electromagnetic coupling. So if my Lagrangian contains this coupling, and this is just a standard electromagnetic coupling to the photon, this piece, if I write it in terms of the new fields, is going to give me E times QF, and this is the electromagnetic coupling constant. This is its electric charge. And now I have, remember, in terms of, oh, actually, sorry. Why did I write this? Sorry, my new fields are my old fields are written as functions of new fields. Sorry, but now if I put this transformation into here, what I get is f bar eqf a prime mu minus S epsilon X prime mu. So the effect of getting rid of this kinetic mixing term is to generate an effective coupling between my X prime, which is going to correspond to the to my Z prime gauge boson, to pairs of standard model fermions. And the effective coupling strength is going to be the electromagnetic coupling times this small mixing factor. So the upshot of this is that I annihilate to pairs of these gauge bosons. But these gauge bosons then mix, and sometimes you write it this way. The gauge boson, you can think of it as mixing with a photon and decaying eventually into pairs of standard model fermions. So this looks a little bit complicated, and you might be wondering why I didn't just write down a coupling, let's say, to W plus W minus. Yes?
Why is the photon not a hypercharge?
What you really have in the underlying gauge invariant theory is a kinetic mixing with a hypercharge.
Okay.
But after electroweak symmetry breaking, which is happening at, let's say, at 100 GeV, you're left with this mixing with the photon. You also have a residual kinetic mixing with the Z, the standard model Z. But it turns out that ends up getting suppressed.
Epsilon suppressed?
Sorry?
Epsilon suppressed?
Actually, a little bit more. Okay. You actually get a mass suppression.
Oh, like MZ over little...
Like MZX over MZ.
Right.
At least at low energies. Yeah. Well, actually, incidentally, in passing, what I've done here is I've gone to diagonal kinetic terms. You don't have to do that, though. What I could have done instead is treated this off-diagonal kinetic mixing term as an interaction. And it turns out that the Feynman vertex for that goes like basically epsilon p squared. So if I was to write this diagram in terms of the mixing thing, I would have my external zx. So I cut off the propagator for that if I compute its decay. And that this vertex gives me an epsilon p squared. And my photon propagator would give me a 1 over p squared. And then I just get the usual decay. So the epsilon p squared cancels the 1 over p squared in the photon propagator. And I just get an epsilon times an effective coupling of zx to photon to FF bar. So there are different ways to handle that. But for example, if you thought about the same thing with the standard model Z, for the standard model Z, I would get a 1 over mz squared in the propagator. So that's a suppression. Okay. Anyway, getting back to this, my zx now decays to fermion antifermion. And so far, this hasn't helped me in that if my zx is still pretty heavy, I'm going to get both quarks and electrons, or quarks and leptons, because I'm coupling to everything proportionally to electric charge. But the trick is that I want to make MZX to be lighter than about twice the pion mass. So if my ZX is lighter than about twice the pion mass, the upshot of this is that my ZX can only decay to E plus E minus, or mu plus E minus. So the point is here that by going through this light gauge boson, I still have relatively democratic couplings to hadrons versus leptons. But I can use kinematics in the sense of a very light ZX coming out to enhance the final annihilation into leptons. In principle, I could also get nu bar or three photons, but these are very suppressed. So these are very suppressed, and they typically go through loops. So basically, all the time, I only get leptons from this annihilation. So this is the first nice thing. The second nice thing, and this is a bit less obvious, and that is that I can also get within the setup, the sigma v today can be significantly bigger than sigma v during thermal freezeout. And the reason for this is something called a Sommerfeld enhancement. And the idea of a Sommerfeld enhancement, and this is a quantum mechanical fact, but it is that suppose I have two particles that have an attractive force between them, and I'm looking at the scattering of these two particles. The scattering of the two particles can be enhanced if at low velocities because they spend a lot of time close to each other, and at low velocities, the attractive force effectively pulls them closer together than they would be otherwise. And in terms of diagrams, you can think of this as coming from multiple ZX exchanges. Before you annihilate. So this Sommerfeld enhancement effect, it's only really important when the mass of the thing annihilating is very, very heavy compared to the force mediator. And also V much, much less than 1, where V is the relative velocity. And just to give you an idea, the typical velocity of dark matter in the galactic halo is about 10 to the minus 3. And during thermal freezeout, it's more like 0.1. And the typical size of the Sommerfeld enhancement, in at least over a wide range of velocities, goes like 1 over V. So with the 1 over V enhancement, I can get roughly a factor of 100 enhancement in the effective annihilation cross-section today relative to thermal freezeout. So in this picture, a second nice feature is that I can have just regular old thermal freezeout, but I can have a Sommerfeld enhancement of the annihilation cross-section today such that I still end up with the right amount, such that I explain the Pamela signal. So this picture, I should cite people, is by a very nice paper by Nima Arkani Hamed. Try to get all the names right. Doug Finkbeiner, Tracy Slatyer, and Neil Weiner. And it's 2008, and I think it's October. So this is a very nice picture, and there are lots of nice offshoots. So it turns out that this light Z prime gives you interesting signals in low energy experiments. And I guess you must all know Philip and Natalia. Philip and Natalia are theorists, but they're actually working on an experiment to try to detect precisely this kind of this kind of ZX. Sometimes it's called a dark photon. So it's not actually a photon in that it has a small mass, but it acts a lot like a photon in that it couples like electric charge. Yeah, but remember here, the dark matter is still pretty heavy. It's just the force mediator is light. But in principle, you could also have light dark matter. It wouldn't explain this. So I mean, if your dark matter is too light, you can't explain Pamela.
Then that Pamela is just something completely astrophysical.
Yeah, so actually, this is what I should answer. Tibor, you asked about this. So I should also mention that there's a small fly in the ointment in that just because the spectrum is turning up doesn't necessarily mean it's dark matter. And right now, there have been various astrophysical explanations proposed. But right now, the leading astrophysical explanation are pulsars. So what you have in a pulsar are very, very strong magnetic fields. And these magnetic fields in pulsars are thought to be a source of a particle acceleration. And in terms of Fermilab, the thinking is that you could actually pair produce an E plus E minus pair. And then the positron you produce within that very strong magnetic field gets accelerated by the pulsar. And that in fact, is what you're seeing as a signal. So now, given the fact that positrons don't travel very efficiently, the pulsar would tend to have to be very close, and actually probably even closer than the dark matter case, in the sense that the flux of positrons you get from pulsars is not expected to be all that big. So one suggested way to test this pulsar hypothesis is that even though these positron cosmic rays get really scrambled by diffusion, the pulsar typically has to be so close that you might get an anisotropy. In that, if this Pamela signal is coming from a single nearby pulsar, you might get an anisotropy, the net direction of E plus. So this wouldn't be a huge anisotropy in the sense that most of the positrons are really getting scrambled by diffusion, but you still might have a remnant anisotropy left over because these things are all coming from a very nearby source. And this might be detectable. This is very difficult to do experimentally, but it's being looked into. Okay, so I think I should wrap up there. In the next class, I want to finish up indirect detection, and I'm going to talk about two things. The first thing I want to talk about are photon signals, so photon cosmic rays, in the form of gamma rays or radio frequency or X-rays. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is indirect detection signals involving stars. So dark matter can get captured in a star and do interesting stuff there. So for example, in the case of our sun can capture dark matter. In that case, you would expect the dark matter to float to the bottom of the sun and possibly annihilate. And for the most part, these annihilation products are just stopped in the sun and you don't see them, except for the case of neutrinos. So annihilation to neutrinos inside the sun might give us a visible neutrino signal from the sun. So I'll talk about that tomorrow.